A sharp winter wind blows through the streets of the Lower East Side of Manhattan in New York. It's late afternoon and the sun hovers over the horizon, casting a cool light onto the tall red brick tenement buildings. Darkness is encroaching. This is a vibrant but poor working class Jewish community, normally filled with the hollering and banter of pushcart vendors. But it's February the 5th, 1944. A Saturday, the Sabbath. The Yiddish theatres and kosher markets are closed, the streets empty, except for Klaus Fuchs. He is standing outside the Henry Street Settlement House, a hub for the city's immigrant poor, providing shelter and support. He's wearing tweeds, carrying a book in one hand and a green tennis ball in the other. As he waits, he sees across a fenced building site a short, full-faced man in glasses walking towards him. He's wearing a dark suit and an overcoat. He's also wearing gloves, but oddly, carrying a second pair. The man crosses the street and approaches Fuchs.
"Excuse me, what's the way to Chinatown?"
Fuchs replies, "I think Chinatown closes at 5 o'clock." Klaus Fuchs has been in America for just over a month, but he's now made contact with his new handler, Harry Gold, the Soviet Union's Agent Goose. From the BBC World Service, I'm Rosa Ellis, and this is Season 2 of The Bomb. Episode 5, An Irreversible Reaction. MI5 had concluded that Klaus Fuchs would be safer in the US, away from his communist friends in Britain. How wrong they were. My great-aunt and Soviet spy Ursula Kuczynski had worked at the Henry Street settlement 15 years previously, and she has arranged this meeting with the green tennis ball, extra pair of gloves and obscure code words. Within weeks of arriving stateside, Klaus Fuchs is now walking through Manhattan with an agent for Soviet intelligence. Fuchs insists on being called by his real name. He's nervous and worries that if anybody who knows him hears him being addressed by his code name, it will raise suspicions. Gold senses his unease and makes small talk as they go into the metro and head uptown, where they end up on 3rd Avenue. Gold takes them to a restaurant, but Fuchs is not impressed.
He's very critical of Gold, actually.
Author Mike Rossiter.
He doesn't like the fact that Gold constantly looks behind him. He thinks this all it does is brings you to the notice of people. He doesn't like meeting Gold in a restaurant. And he's very critical, and he tells Gold this. He says, look, we're only going to meet for business, never in the same place twice. We'll only wait for each other for 5 minutes, and then we blow it. He tells Gold this is the way it's going to work.
Fuchs may be new in town, but he's not new to espionage, and he's not taking any risks. He knows nothing about Harry Gold, but can tell that he has a scientific background. He's right. Gold is a chemist and is a courier for Soviet intelligence, providing them with secrets from within American science and industry. Klaus doesn't know it, but he's also handling David Greenglass, who's the machinist on the atomic bomb project. Years later, Gold and Greenglass will testify against Greenglass's own sister, Ethel, and her husband, Julius Rosenberg, for their atomic espionage, for which they will both be sent to the electric chair. In America, the stakes are high, and in the world of espionage, nobody can be fully trusted. So, as Fuchs talks with Gold in the restaurant, he's still nervous. Biographer Nancy Thorndike Greenspan.
He felt that sitting with somebody who he didn't know that much about, and was the FBI onto this person? You don't know who these contacts are. You're hoping that it's all been vetted and is safe, but you don't know that. He wasn't very talkative. He just wanted to eat and get out of there.
Gold needs to win Fuchs's trust, but it's proving no easy task. Long silences make for an awkward dinner. Fuchs's unease is palpable. They settle the bill and button up their coats before heading back out into the cold night, where Fuchs starts to loosen up.
And he did tell him a little bit about what research was being done, that there were various places the research was being done around the United States. He explained that it was being compartmentalized. The work that he was working on was once again gaseous diffusion, and that's all he would know about.
As the men part ways, they make arrangements for future meetings and devise a cover story for their friendship. If anybody ever asks, they will say they met at a symphony concert at the world-famous Carnegie Hall. Fuchs's work on gaseous diffusion in New York is one small part of a monumental scientific and industrial endeavour. America's atomic bomb program is a behemoth, codenamed the Manhattan Project.
It costs $26 billion in today's dollars.
Cindy Kelly from the Atomic Heritage Foundation.
Danish physicist Niels Bohr said that building an atomic bomb could never be done without turning the United States into one huge factory. And basically, that's what the Manhattan Project did. There were hundreds of manufacturers, large and small, in nearly every state that contributed. They also roped in the leading universities, University of Chicago, University of California, Harvard, Princeton, MIT. From sea to sea, they used the talent that they could find. And a major source of talent was the U.S. industry. You could go down the list of who's who in American corporations, and they were on it. By the full count, there were some 600,000 workers employed by the Manhattan Project.
The race between the leading powers in World War II for a nuclear bomb is a race in which the competitors don't know who is in the lead. But what they do know is that whoever crosses the finish line first wins the war. A new global order will be theirs to shape, and the Americans are throwing everything at it. Over the coming months, Fuchs works with relentless intensity on the problem of enriching uranium, a vital step if the bomb is to become reality. But as in Britain, the supposedly watertight security surrounding the project has elementary and fatal flaws.
Fuchs would type and write material. He would type it up or get it typed up from his longhand notes. That would be printed off, mimeographed, numbered for security reasons, and given out to the people who, for security reasons, needed to read that material. A copy of that paper would be sent back to Fuchs. At the same time, what would be sent back to him was his notes and a carbon of the original document. So he had three documents that he could choose to give away. And normally a copy of the carbon would be wrapped up and would be handed over. Nobody would ever notice that the numbered secure document in his possession had ever left his possession at all.
It is these top secret documents that he passes to Gold. They always meet at night, but shifting locations all around the city. On busy streets, deserted side alleys, or in tired cafes, Fuchs informs him not only of his work on uranium enrichment, but also what he knows of the wider project. After each meeting, Gold immediately goes to meet his controller on a nearby street corner and hands over the files. Moscow Center is delighted with the information they receive. They've been under immense pressure over their failings to infiltrate US war research. And immense pressure under Stalin can very quickly prove deadly. So Fuchs is a lifeline they grasp with both hands. They send a message to New York, encouraging Gold to work his contact, assuring him that Agent Rest, aka Klaus Fuchs, is a major figure with experience in espionage. On a balmy night in late spring 1944, Fuchs heads into the city to meet Gold. He tells him that the Americans are working towards a large-scale launch of the bomb at a place called Camp Y. Fuchs's work in New York is coming to a close, but he doesn't know which way the winds are blowing for his next assignment. Will his bosses decide he needs to stay in America and glean as much information as possible there? Or do they want his expertise put back to work on Britain's own atomic program? He tells Gold about his sister Crystal, who lives near Boston, and his other relatives in Germany. I'm surprised he does this. Mixing family with espionage will prove risky for Fuchs. All the while, the head of the Manhattan Project, General Groves, is obsessed with secrecy and paranoid about a leak. America may have been turned into one big atomic bomb-making factory, but nobody can know about it.
Well, the project was deliberately kept from Congress. There was a blackout with the press. The press were not allowed to report on this. There was a school newspaper at the University of Chicago where the young editors decided it'd be interesting to do a profile of Arthur Holly Compton, who was actually heading the Metallurgical Laboratory, which was a code name for the Manhattan Project in the University of Chicago. There were 5,000 people working there. So the paper innocently interviewed Compton, who said he was working on atomic research, which is true. That's what he had been doing before the war. And it, you know, it continued in a different guise. But the FBI saw the paper and saw this reference, and they went around the entire campus and confiscated all the papers.
Wow.
And wanted to smash the printing presses. Right.
The FBI are reading student journalism. That's
exactly. But that was how uptight everybody was about the possibility of a leak.
It isn't the student hacks they need to worry about. When the team of some 60 British nuclear scientists arrived in the US, the scale and scope of their work was not certain. The coordinator for the British program, Michael Perrin, knew about the security concerns around Fuchs, and he was nervous about having him away on the other side of the Atlantic.
It was a very circumscribed amount of work they were supposed to do. It was going to end after a few months, and some of those people would come back. Was Fuchs one of those people who would come back? And Perrin said yes, he wasn't going to be staying.
But events in America are now unfolding beyond his control. The Manhattan Project is racing ahead, and Fuchs is proving to be an invaluable asset. Of the 17 scientific reports produced by the British team in New York, he authors 10 of them.
The British appreciated that he really was a very, very good physicist. He was highly respected. He had done a lot of work on very complicated problems, often on his own. He had an amazing memory. He was a fabulous mathematician and a calculator. You just, you know, he'd sit down and calculate anything in no time. I'm talking about, you know, high-level math. And he had a lot of physics know-how.
Michael Perrin may want Fuchs back on home soil as soon as possible. But in America, Rudolf Piles is at the head of the British team. It's Piles who recruited Fuchs at Birmingham University. It's Piles who had taken Fuchs into his home and family life. And it's Piles who is now benefiting on a day-to-day basis from Fuchs's intellectual prowess.
Rudy Piles decided he wanted Klaus to stay longer. He felt very comfortable with Fuchs, and I think it was his security blanket, because when he needed a go-to person, Fuchs was the person he went to, and he wanted him there. So because Michael Perrin was the administrator of all of this and the organizer, he went to Perrin and let him know that he wanted Fuchs to stay.
So once again, the British government turns to MI5 for their assessment.
They said, yes, it's okay for him to stay, and you can let the Americans know that he is going to be staying there. You know, there was just a formal process that went on. But they said to Michael Perrin, don't mention his, quote, political proclivities in the U.S. We don't think he'll try to make political contacts there, so it really isn't an issue. But don't let him know, you know, don't give him the background that we, you know, he's had communist ties. They specifically told him not to do it. Consequently, Perrin did not.
MI5 have moved from catch-up to cover-up, while Klaus Fuchs, former German Communist Party activist and associate of known communists, embeds himself deeper into the biggest, most secretive, and most consequential scientific mission in the history of mankind. And as far as MI5 are concerned, the Americans should never find out. It was Winston Churchill who coined the phrase the special relationship to define the American and British alliance, but neither side really trusts the other. Britain is desperate to place itself at the heart of the US-led programme, so it can gather as much knowledge and intelligence as possible. And Fuchs understands this game all too well. The more indispensable he is to the Americans, the more valuable he is to the Brits. And if he keeps both sides of the transatlantic alliance sweet, then he can keep on funneling nuclear secrets to the Russians. A mission he feels a duty to fulfill. And he's not alone.
Many of the scientists there felt it should be shared with them, and that it wasn't right not to, that if they could, they would, but they couldn't. Well, he did. But there were an awful lot of people who felt the same way he did, that it was important to let Soviets know it, that it would stop an arms race, that they would be allies, that there would be less threat in the world by having them in cooperation.
The political ideals of communism, the logic of nuclear parity, and the anti-fascist militarism of the Soviet Union all buttress Fuchs's belief that what he is doing is right. But his reading of Marxist philosophy gives him something more. It gives him an agency and authority from which he believes he can shape the course of history itself.
The idea which gripped me most was the belief that in the past, man has been unable to understand his own history and the forces leading to the further development of human society. That now, for the first time, man understands the historical forces and he is able to control them. And that, therefore, for the first time, he will be truly free.
The Russians now have Germany on the back foot. The Red Army defeat of the Nazis at the brutal Battle of Stalingrad has been a decisive turning point in the war. Some 2 million people were killed in one of the bloodiest battles in warfare, but Hitler's great gamble failed. The Nazis have been forced to withdraw considerable forces from other areas in occupied Europe to replace German losses on the Eastern Front. But despite the Nazis' best efforts, the Red Army is energised and on the march into the heartlands of mainland Europe. It's taken 4 years of brutal warfare and millions of Russian deaths. But the tide has turned in Moscow's favour.
You know, the sympathy of people towards the Soviet Union was enormous. They knew that the Soviet Union was having the main burden of fighting against Germany. Everyone knew the Leningrad blockade, the battle for Moscow, the Kursk battle, Stalingrad. Everyone knew that. And a lot of people wanted to help.
And then, in the summer of 1944, Hitler has another problem to worry about.
D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress. The Allied Commander-in-Chief, General Eisenhower, has issued an order of the day addressed to each individual of the Allied Expeditionary Force. In it, he said, "Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory."
American, British, and Canadian troops have landed on the beaches of Normandy in the largest ever seaborne invasion. The liberation of France has begun. Victory over the Nazis feels tantalisingly close. Unless, of course, Hitler's scientists have a nuclear bomb being constructed to drop on England. Around this time, the Brits are deliberating whether to bring Fuchs home to work on the British nuclear programme or send him to join the team at a secret location in the New Mexico desert. Events are moving fast. The Manhattan Project has progressed to a point where a huge diffusion plant to enrich uranium is being built. Rudolf Piles has already been on a 3-week trip to the location, where the theory of the atomic bomb is being turned into reality. The outcome of the war and the future of the entire world is in the balance. But in the world of espionage, nothing can be taken for granted. In August 1944, Harry Gold and Klaus Fuchs have a meeting scheduled in front of the Bell Cinema near the Brooklyn Museum of Art. Gold turns up, but...
there was no Klaus. And it's very nerve-wracking for your handler to be there and not have the other person arrive. Are they not arriving because they've been caught and are being interviewed? You don't know why they're not there, especially when they always do arrive. So it is a very uncomfortable position for someone like Harry Gold to be involved with.
They have a backup meeting planned. Gold turns up, but there's no sign of Fuchs.
People in Moscow are going crazy because Klaus Fuchs was the most important source of information on the bomb, and they lost him.
Time to panic. For Harry Gold and his handlers from Soviet intelligence, this is not a good situation to be in under Stalin's regime. Desperate times call for desperate measures. So they scramble and dig around and finally find his New York address. Breaking with all protocol, Gold goes to Klaus's apartment at 128 West 77th Street.
It was a brownstone on the Upper West Side. A very nice building, very nice neighborhood.
He's carrying a book by Thomas Mann. Inside the cover, he has written Fuchs's name and address. If anybody asks him why he's there, he can just say he found the book and is returning it.
He finds Klaus's apartment and he knocks, and the neighbor puts her head out and kind of starts talking to him, and the janitor comes up.
Hello. I'm looking for Dr. Klaus Fuchs.
Gold is nervous and feeling exposed. He's struggling to make himself clear to them.
You don't happen to know where I might find him, do you? I promised to...
But he pulls himself together and manages to explain that he's looking for Dr. Klaus Fuchs.
And the two of them said, oh, well, he's not here anymore. He's somewhere on a boat. He left on a boat.
A boat? That is not what Gold wants to hear. But luckily, they're wrong. What none of them know is that Klaus Fuchs has embarked on a cross-continental train journey from New York to New Mexico. Upon arriving in Santa Fe, he reports to a small, inconspicuous office in the center of town to speak to Dorothy McKibben,
who is often referred to as the gatekeeper for Los Alamos.
Los Alamos, aka Camp Y, is the nerve center of the American nuclear bomb program.
Dorothy would get people's information and match it with her records of who she was expecting to come to Los Alamos and issue them a badge and a housing assignment.
And with that entrance pass safely in his wallet, Fuchs gets into an army vehicle with his colleagues and heads out into the surrounding wilderness.
It was the Wild West. It is a gorgeous journey through very, at first, flat desert landscape with some very strange, dramatic mesas rising up on the horizon. These are kind of flat-topped mountains.
As the road winds its way through the canyons, it may be beautiful, but it's far from relaxing.
Because the road is perilously close to the edge of this long drop-off. I don't know how many carts and mules and belongings careened over the side, but I'm sure there was more than a few. It was slow going getting up to Los Alamos, but the view is breathtaking. If they could focus on how magically beautiful this landscape is, with a series of flat-top mountains divided by deep canyons with small rivers running through them and sagebrush and juniper and other hardy vegetation clinging to the little crevices along the sides of these roads. It was beautiful.
After more than an hour, the jeep starts to climb a hair-raising track up a mountainside.
Red rose rocks with some yellow gleamed in the sunlight. I mean, there was nothing of civilization in sight.
And finally, they breathe a sigh of relief as they reach the top and have the world at their feet. There's a pure blue sky above and a panoramic view 360 degrees around. Nestled in among the jaw-dropping natural landscape, an extraordinary sight is spread out below. A newly constructed industrial town that only months previously had been a remote boys' boarding school where wealthy industrialists sent their children. As the jeep pulls up to the security post, a soldier steps out and checks their passes. He scans their documents and looks up at their faces. He pauses for just a fraction too long, and then waves them in.
Arriving in Los Alamos, the impression is of a beehive of activity. There's a lot of people coming and going. It's a dusty kind of frontier town. There are no paved roads. Some of the sidewalks are wooden planks that people can walk on in the main part of town. But for the most, you have to put up with sinking in the mud if it just rained or getting very dusty.
This is where some of the best minds in the world are focused on one goal, building the first atomic bomb. For everyone inside the camp, it's their whole world. For the rest of the world, it doesn't even exist. It's cloaked in extreme security and surveillance. The military patrol on horseback, and there are high barbed wire fences and guarded checkpoints in and out. The Russians have no idea where Klaus Fuchs is. How could they? He's in the most secret place on Earth, Los Alamos. And what are Fuchs's plans? Has he deliberately given Gold the slip? The KGB can only guess and hope. Next time on The Bomb.
If you're in the theoretical division, you know everything that's going on in Los Alamos.
They wired each one with a detonator that was to go off at exactly the same nanosecond. Everything had to work perfectly.
You know, the physics was exciting. They knew what they were working towards.
They needed all the talent they could get, and Fuchs was there at the ready.
He was utterly horrified. Mm. Utterly, utterly horrified.
You can subscribe to The Bomb on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd leave a rating or a review to help other people find it. The Bomb was presented by me, Rosa Ellis. It was written and produced by Zach Brophy. The story editor was Emma Harding. Alice McKee was the assistant producer. Our producer in Berlin was Sabine Scherek. Klaus Fuchs was played by Marcus Calvin, with additional performances by David Hounslow. Sound design was by Tim Nielsen at Skywalker Sound and Eloise Whitmore. Original music was composed by Trevor Gorekis, with additional original music by Ben Marshall. The executive producer was Glyn Tansley, and the podcast was commissioned by Simon Pitts at the BBC World Service.